This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fun drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
Welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, career changers, and I should say the sporty, talented athletes who make up the food industry. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
For the first, is that the first time you're saying those words? Oh, this episode is going to be played later. It's not going live.
Good point.
We'll skip that. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And we are joined this week by Nona Lim, founder of Nona Lim. And Nona, we'll ask you to tell us all about your food business. So I'm gonna gloss over that now. But just very briefly, you are a former competitive fencer, a former management consultant, a serial entrepreneur in food. And your current company is Nona Lim. Why don't we start there? Why don't you tell us about your company, Nona
Sure,
Lim, and what you do, and
So Nona Lim is a modern Asian platform. We try to bring together wonderful, delicious Asian comfort food, but also making sure that it has clean ingredients, it's healthier, better for you, and we try to put them into convenient formats, whether it is on the go or cook at home packages.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the story. How did you end up starting this company, and what were the other companies that you had before this?
That would be quite a long story.
Well, we're here for an hour, so let's dig in.
So I grew up in Singapore, and you can tell from the accent that I'm not American, or not by birth. So grew up in Singapore, studied there, and actually spent about 8 years in London, working as a management consultant and software consultant as well, software consulting. Moved to the Bay Area and decided that I want to try something totally new. So I decided to go into the food industry. Back in 2006, I started the first meal kit delivery business. That was before Blue Apron, HelloFresh, and all those incumbents. It was a little bit too ahead of its time. That was before iPhones existed, before Facebook was big, before Instagram existed.
How did you come up with that idea?
Well, you know, I think that it was definitely an experiment, which is I love all the wonderful ingredients that you get in the Bay Area, which is where I moved to from London, and I wanted to create something to make it easier for busy professionals to cook at home. Back in London, in Marks & Spencer's, Waitrose, you have a lot of ready-to-cook meals, but you don't really have that in the US. So I wanted to leverage a little bit of my tech background, and so actually started by getting 10 couples, friends of ours, in the Bay Area and say, hey, can I deliver food to you every week? You know, did that for about a month and then put together a focus group, asked them for their feedback, etc., and then decided, okay, I'm going to launch this as a subscription business. We're going to deliver once a week.
Such a consultant's approach to starting a food business. Focus groups and feedback and, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Bay Area obviously has like an abundance of amazing fresh produce. And I know that nutrition is really important to you. So was that kind of connected to your background as an athlete?
Absolutely. So I started competitive fencing at kind of a late stage. Well, I did it in college and then stopped when I was in London and picked it back up, a different weapon. So by then, my competitors were usually like a decade younger or maybe,
oh, wow.
Yeah, or maybe even up to like 12, 15 years younger. So I had to get every advantage I could.
You win a lot?
Depending on what level, yes. At the local level, absolutely. At the regional level, absolutely. At the world level, I guess, you know, at the top of my career, I was probably in the top 80, you know.
So, yes.
But that's still like not like Olympic medalist. So
but
not
you
quite
almost
there.
Made it to the Olympics, right?
That's right. So in 2012, I lost by 1 point in the qualification. Oh. So almost made it to the Olympics. I was devastated when that didn't happen. And I decided to give up fencing and focus. Well, and had a baby. And then to focus on the business afterwards. Because before that, I was, you know, running that online meal kit delivery business and, you know, training 4 or 5 times a week, competing every weekend or every other weekend and spending maybe 2 weeks out of 6 weeks away from home, either at training camps in Asia or Europe. So it definitely made it hard to try to be good at both things at the same time.
How did you get into fencing? What was it about fencing in particular that attracted you?
Oh, I love fencing because it is such a mental sport. It's one of those where you don't have to be the strongest, the fastest, the tallest. You know, you can really make use of everything from, you know, what kind of tactics you want to do, what your reaction speed is, what sort of distance sense you have, you can set things up. So it's one of those where, you know, we'll be training at the club and I could be fencing with maybe a young 5'10" or 6-foot boy and still beat them or beat the younger girls, because it is really not about how strong or fast you are, but how you put together all those different elements. So it's a very intense intellectual sport. And it's one of those things where I can really take my mind off everything else and be here and be now. You cannot be distracted. Yeah.
I mean, do you kind of get in that space when you're cooking or developing, you know, new recipes for your product line?
Honestly, fencing is probably the only activity where I can maintain almost a zen-like state, mm-hmm. where, you know, if you're too tense, you can't do well, you know, so you have to be kind of in the in-between state. It has taught me a lot about the business, just how to be present, mm-hmm. you know, and when things go wrong, how to really let go immediately, because if you don't do that, you end up losing the next few points. And sometimes you have to do that in business as well. And how to stay calm and not be tense in lots of different situations, whether it is presenting to investors or speaking in front of a big group. So I've definitely gotten a lot from fencing.
There's also, I think, I fenced in high school. I was actually the captain of my high school fencing team. I was certainly not the best fencer.
Which weapon?
Foil, which was all we had in the New York City high school system.
So there are different weapons, you like as a fencer?
Can tell you more
absolutely.
Than I
can. Foil and epee and saber. So foil and epee are more stabbing weapons when you score with the tip of the point. Saber is more a slashing weapon and it's a little bit faster and a little bit more aggressive.
Which weapon did you compete in?
Saber.
Oh, wow.
I knew it. I knew you were going to say slasher. I could just tell. Wait, okay, so Ethan, you did foil?
Well,
so
I was, right, I was on my high school fencing team.
Okay.
I was never great, but I think there is, you know, when you're cooking, there's a certain amount of your emotional state that manifests in the food. If, I don't know, at least for me, like if I'm really angry, like my food is going to taste a certain way, or I'm feeling stressed or something, or if I'm really relaxed and easygoing, my food tastes different. And I also remember feeling that when I was competing in fencing, that it, like the other things that were happening in my life were definitely sort of more visible in that moment, that like hyper concentration that you find
absolutely
when you're fencing or when you're cook, at least for me. Maybe I'm anyway, whatever, when when I'm cooking. Yeah.
So you did fencing when you were in college in Singapore. Right.
I was doing foil then, because back then they didn't have saber for girls, for women.
Okay.
They thought that, you know, saber was too fast for women, was a bit too aggressive. And of course the US is never believed in that, right? So the US always had female fencers in saber, so they were one of the first pioneers. And that's why when I started working and I quit fencing, and when I wanted to get fit again, I was like, oh wow, they have saber for women now. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of very curious and took it out and decided that, oh, I was still okay with it.
Yeah, I guess I would also just kind of like to hear about your life growing up in Singapore, because obviously those flavors and a lot of those ingredients have, you know, found their way into your brand and are a big part of how you cook. I've never been to Singapore.
I've been a couple of times, but I have not spent a lot of, they've been short trips both times.
I would say if you have watched Crazy Rich Asians, the only part that I think is really reflective of Singaporean.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's basically a documentary, no?
The hawker centers.
Yeah.
I'm just a crazy Asian.
Wait, what's a hawker center?
So a hawker center, they call them street foods in other parts of the world. But over there, you know, I would say maybe 40, 50 years ago, we moved from kind of street food vendors that you get maybe pictures of in Bangkok and places like that to something a little bit more organized. So it would be kind of like a food court, and there would be maybe 50 to sometimes even hundreds of vendors, of store vendors in a tiny little 10 by 10 space selling only one thing.
So each person is selling one thing.
Pretty much.
One dish,
like
right?
One dish. It's like chicken rice. You know, so or you have the... maybe a noodle, like a fried noodle dish. And even then, they only sell like two different fried noodle or one fried noodle, and that's it, right? So we would grow up with that, and literally there was a hawker center 3 minutes away from where I lived. Mm-hmm. And every day, you know, not quite every day, but I would walk over and sometimes I would buy things. My dad would ask me to pick something up, and I would be standing right in front because the space is 10 by 10, so you can watch them cook right in front of you. Right, so I would just stand there and watch how they are, you know, fry the noodle. First they put in the oil, and then they crack an egg, and then they throw in the noodle. So I would learn a lot of dishes by just watching how they make it, which is really fun.
And often it's sort of a family business, multi-generational, with that specialty in that particular dish or technique or style of cooking, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, they would have done it, you know, the parents or grandparents might have done it for like 40 years and then goes on to the next generation, and so on and so forth. Of course, in Singapore right now, I think that there is a danger in that a lot of the vendors are maybe in their 70s and 80s, and so you don't always have a lot of young people wanting to take it up because it is very hard work. You know, you could be working at 4 or 5 in the morning until pretty late at night. Yeah.
Yeah, the Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations, late in the show, did a great episode on Singapore, and I think almost the entire episode was focused on hawker centers and interviewing families, parents, and kids, and talking about their kind of daily routine.
Yeah, and it would cost you like $2.
Yeah, right, which is great, but also kind of part of the problem, right, that maybe is not sustainable financially in the way that some of the kids taking over the business
Those
would
kids.
Like it to be. I know, they just want to make money.
No, I mean, I loved how you described it, though. Like, I could tell it was almost poetic or lyrical. You were like, they fried the noodles and cracked the egg. So, like, as you were younger watching this, were you pretty fascinated by this? So,
oh, I was. I was always so interested in food. And then my dad would drag me up. I must have been like six years old or something. So at about 6 in the morning, which is pretty early, you know, he would wake me up and drag me to the wet market. And so in those days, it's called literally the wet market because the floors are wet. And that's where you have all this fish, meats, butchers, things like that. And literally you pick your live chicken. Mm-hmm. Kind of sounds a bit weird now, but yeah, you pick the chicken that you want and you go off and you come back half an hour later and the chicken would be plucked and cleaned and ready for you.
What would you look for in a chicken that you wanted? Like the way it moved?
Well, the nice thing is that because it is so fresh and alive, you can see that it is very well taken care of, like the feathers, you know, the plump and things like that.
So you just want like a good looking...
Yeah, good looking, fluffy, kind of like a healthy looking chicken.
Yeah.
But fish for sure, right? My dad would show me, it's like, oh yeah, you know, you press it, you look at the eyes should be very clear, you pull under the gills, you look, you know, you open it up, make sure that the gills look good and you press the meat and the meat should have a good texture to it and bounce back. So I learned a lot about ingredients, and that's why my dad dragged me up at 6 in the morning, because then you get the freshest ingredients because you're like the first to market.
So you incorporated all of that background, education, experience that you'd had as a kid into your various food businesses. How did you take that kind of that value system and apply it to food startups that you've founded here in the US?
Yeah, you know, I think the three big values that, you know, have constantly stayed with me throughout the evolution of my different food ventures is that number one, flavor, right? It doesn't matter how healthy it is. You don't really want to eat sawdust. You know, it could be very trendy. People might want it because it's so-called trendy, but they're not going to continue eating it if
right.
it doesn't taste good. So I think first and foremost, flavor. You know,
yeah.
so I always, always want to make sure that everything that I do tastes good. And the second is ingredients. Really looking at sourcing the ingredients, but thinking about not just what goes into it, but what doesn't go into it. Right, so the coconut cream that we use is only coconut and water, has no preservatives in it. You know, we work with, for our green curry bowl, fresh lemongrass, ginger, shallots, and we puree that. It takes a lot more work, but you're just getting so much more flavor than, let's say, we use a frozen puree. Right, our carrot ginger soup, we're plucking fresh thyme, organic thyme, and we're cooking with that instead of like an extract. And so it just makes a huge difference in the flavor profile. And I think that has always stayed with me. So those two were the biggest things that came from my upbringing. And then the third is convenience, you know.
Leading the American way.
The American way, yes. You know, although in Singapore, it's actually really convenient because you could walk 3 minutes and buy food, right? Like on Manhattan, you're full of restaurants everywhere. You know, you could walk somewhere and just get something. But for the most part of the U.S., that isn't the case. So how can we have that kind of convenience, you know, still be available for
right.
consumers?
I love your motto. I saw it. It's a hashtag, all flavor, no crap. I feel like that kind of also speaks to like your life as a fencer, a slasher. You're just like direct, straightforward. I love that. All flavor, no crap.
Absolutely. And I think that represents not just our food, but definitely our company culture and my personality as well. Yeah, I have quite a low tolerance for BS.
So your first food business was this meal kit company. What happened with that and what did you do next?
So I think I've learned a lot from that, which is number one, if it's going to be more, if you're going to disrupt everything, right, and be so innovative, you need a lot of money to educate the consumers, and because, and I didn't fundraise, which was a big mistake. Number two, it was just too ahead, right? Social media didn't exist. So how would you reach your customers? The customer acquisition strategy was just really difficult to implement. And so that it was just difficult to scale because of that. And then the next pivot was, you know, I ended up getting to know a lot of functional medicine doctors, nutritionists, dietitians in the Bay Area, and created a food-based detox program based on elimination diet. Again, a little bit too ahead of my time. That was in maybe 2009 or so, and that was when juice cleanse was just coming to play, and people really didn't even understand what detox means. And so what was great about that product was that, you know, we had a lot of customers who lost weight, their triglycerides fell, you know, cholesterol dropped, went off medication. So it was really, really impactful. But it was really expensive, right? You're talking about organic, gluten-free, sustainable, seafood, grass-fed beef, et cetera, et cetera. And so you're talking about $350 a week. And so the price point was just too high. And again, not very scalable. So I've taken away a lot of lessons from it.
And how did that lead you to your current business?
Well, I think for one thing, I've really learned to slow down my innovation, which is kind of very anti-Silicon Valley, right? Out in the Bay Area, you think a lot about, oh, you want to be innovative,
right.
disruptive.
Right.
I think that you can do that if it really depends on what industry you're in and how much money you can raise. But when it comes to food, you do want to, especially if you're not raising hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, you do really want to know when is it a trend. If you're the only company doing it, it doesn't make a trend. Like in 2014, you know, we launched the first packaged bone broth in Whole Foods, and that was before the Brodo article it appeared in the New York Times, which meant that, you know, nobody knew what bone broth was. And so why is it twice the price of Pacific? And what do you do with it? Right. And so I think I've really learned that you have to find a balance between wanting to bring something that's innovative and interesting, but also really have that touch of familiarity to really help with adoption. Otherwise, you will burn a lot of money with customer education, because we definitely struggled with that a little bit about, you know, when we're so innovative, where do they put us in the store? You know, where do you merchandise? Which review category meetings do you go for? Right. So those were all challenges that we faced even in the last few years, and we're now only really happy that the trends have finally caught up, and so it's great.
So are you kind of like at the head of the pack now?
Yes.
Can you tell us about your bone broth actually? Oh, yeah. Because I feel like that's one of your like signature products.
Yeah. So, you know, we launched them originally in 2014, and we came up with all these really Asian forward flavors, like a Vietnamese beef pho bone broth, or like a coconut lime bone broth, which is really based on like the Thai tom kha kai chicken soup. We had those in stores, and it took a few years for it to gain traction. And then what we did innovate on a few years later was we kept exactly the same products, but we put them into little sippy cups, kind of like a Starbucks coffee cup. And everyone is familiar with a Starbucks coffee cup, right? So we make it something much more convenient and mm-hmm. drinkable, but still with exactly the same high quality product mm-hmm. and those flavors. And that has become really, really popular because, you know, people now understand what bone broth is. They want that convenience. And then what we did as well was that we launched a very rapidly, I think within, it was like less than 6 months of innovation, we launched a turmeric chicken bone broth that has 10 grams of protein. It's pretty low in sodium. It's organic. So it has all the right attributes. You know, that is doing great as well because, you know, everybody loves turmeric. It is very...
Oh, yeah, like turmeric lattes. I think I saw exactly. turmeric ice cream recently.
So I almost now want to be like, I don't want to be number one. I want to be a fast follower. Yeah.
So how have you stayed ahead of the trends throughout your career? How have you, you know, most people are scrambling to catch up. How have you been in front?
You know, I think when I first started, it was really just a gut feel. Mm. I think it was very amorphous. You know, just kind of things that I love, I gravitate towards. Now there's a little bit more systematic. You know, I think a lot of it is still based on my gut, but I spend a lot of time talking to retailers to get what they see because they know what moves in their stores. So I'll spend a lot of time getting their feedback and inputs. Now I look at a lot more data, like Spin's report, etc., to see what kind of flavors are trending, what sort of pack sizes are trending. And at the food shows, sometimes I talk to my contemporaries. And then in food, actually, you know, restaurants. I mean, I used to like to be ahead even of restaurants because I think that, oh gosh, I'm so visionary. And now I've decided that, no, I think I'll let them carry the heavy lifting.
You've done that already. It seems like a challenge for a lot of entrepreneurs is, finding the line between a hobby or a passion and a business, right? There's a lot of people who are doing something that they really enjoy, and maybe it's a side hustle, it's often not a primary source of income, and it's often not a business in the traditional sense with employees and production. And how have you found that balance for yourself, and what's your advice for other entrepreneurs who are trying to make that decision?
You know, I think that I definitely wasn't clear about what I wanted to do. My mom used to tell me when I was young, and I would just ignore her, a knife cannot be sharp on both edges. You have to choose one. And especially since when I was fencing and running my business.
And you were waving around an actual knife.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
In both places.
Analogy.
In both places, you know, and thinking that I could do it all. And I think she's right. You know, I think since I stopped competitive fencing to focus on the business in the last 5 years, it's definitely gotten a lot more momentum. I feel that you have to ask yourself the question, which is, where do you see yourself in 10 years or 15 years? You know, are you building a business as a legacy for your children? Mm. Do you want this to be, you know, a side hustle, or, you know, what do you want to do with it? I eventually went the route of taking some institutional VC money a couple years back, but that has with it a bunch of assumptions. Once you've taken money, you know, you need to give them an exit. There are certain things that they usually require, which is they do require, you know, a certain aggressive growth rate. And to get that growth rate, you usually have to invest in having a good team. So you have to bring in great people, but great people cost a lot of money. And so now, you know, you could end up burning a lot of cash. And so pretty much it's kind of go big or go home, right? Which I'm fine with because, you know, I've spent kind of many years just dabbling, trying things out, figuring things out. And so I have had the luxury of finding my way and trying to decide what I want to do. And now I think I have a lot more clarity. And so, you know, we do have an amazing team, and I really enjoy that as well. but it's definitely different, you know, kind of... if they decide what you like as well, there are many entrepreneurs who really enjoy the artisanal aspect of it. And because of my management consulting background, I actually really do enjoy the business side of things as well. You know, so I think I that's worked out well for me. I really enjoy what I'm doing right now. Yeah.
The institutional capital into food businesses is a huge topic and pretty controversial. As a food entrepreneur myself, we've had those conversations. And decided not to pursue them. I mean, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because there is this one. I think one of the major criticisms that's often leveled at that is that venture capital in particular came from a tech world where scalability is virtually unlimited, where you have a really good team, and with that team, you can grow really fast. In food, it operates a little bit differently. You're looking at sourcing and supply chains and agriculture and like you were saying earlier, picking the thyme leaves and chopping the shallots. And there's a food just moves more slowly than tech does. Mm-hmm. And so how have you sort of conveyed that either to your investors, or how have your investors come into this conversation? Do they understand that? What were those conversations like early on where an investor might have said, we want your business to, you know, multiply by 5 in terms of revenue in the next 2 years. I mean, some expectations that might have been reasonable, might have been unreasonable. I'm just curious about those conversations, sure. How you handled those.
You know, I think that not all money is created equal. Mm-hmm. Not all institutional money is created equal. And someone used to say that, you know, looking for an investor or finding the right investor is like getting married, right? So you have to spend a lot of time finding, you know, the right partner. I would say it's worse than getting married. Because when you get married, you can always have a divorce. Mm. If you have an investor, you know, you might not even have that. And it is really, you're stuck with the investor for a very, very long time. And so you want to really go into it thoughtfully, regardless of whether you choose to take money or not, right? And that's one. Two is, I think it also depends on the category you're in and what's happening in that category. You know, suddenly, because certain categories are considered hot, right? And beverages seems to be very hot. And so if you land on something that's really cool and you start it, because there's so much money sloshing around, it's very easy for different companies to, you know, who might take your idea, get a whole bunch of investor money, buy that distribution, and totally get ahead of it. So that is that danger. But that's not necessarily the case in every category. So I think a lot of it depends on your actual product and where you play in, and that it's harder if you're doing something innovative and exciting and that is trendy to kind of do it the old way where you're growing a little bit by bit slowly. You know, like I'm not sure, for example, plant-based seems to be so hot right now and there's so much money thrown in there. You know, if you don't have any money at all and you're just doing it really organically, I just don't know. Right? So I think it all depends.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with 2 microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
This is Valerie Lomas, and you are listening to Why Food. And we are here with Nona of Nona Lim.
So right before the break, Nona, you were talking to us about the decision to take on institutional capital, venture capital, to grow your business. Do you have any advice for other entrepreneurs who are thinking about those? There are obviously many ways to approach funding, but if sort of debating bringing on investors or trying to bootstrap a business?
I would say that if you have not taken in any funding yet, you know, there are other things you can do before you take on VC funding, right? In fact, the advice I've always been given was to not take their money for as long as you can. There are microloans available, you know, in the Bay Area, there's Working Solutions, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of other microloan organizations in different parts of the country. That's a good resource. You know, there are leasing companies for equipment. So if you're getting things like equipment, never take VC money for that. You should just take debt if you can. And angels. I think taking angel money is a good way to start as well. But if angels are hard, then you can certainly look at that. But if you're going to take VC money, then you want to be very clear about what your exit is, right?
And by exit, you mean?
Like a sale to a PE, a sale to a strategic, or something like that. If you're thinking that this is a business that you want to build for your next, for the next generation, then it's unlikely that they would be as interested. These days, there's also crowdfunding as well, which is something that you could look into. I would say that, you know, and when looking at VCs, you want to, the way I think about it is that it's kind of like dating, right? Like we say, like, it's like marrying somebody but not having the ability to get a divorce. And so even when you're not, you don't need money, it's the best time to fundraise. Because when you do need money, sometimes it's kind of like, I don't know, you might not get the best deal. And also, you know, think of it as dating, right? You can have lots of conversations. You're dating, but you're not looking to get married. And so you want to take that kind of mentality and approach as well. If you are really thinking about getting VC funding at some point in the future, you know, get to know all those different VCs. Then you will start finding out that, you know, certain VCs like to write certain size checks, invest in companies of certain stages. And so you might not be the right fit for them for a very long time, and you can quickly cross them off the list, so you can be much more efficient. And sometimes talking to VCs as well way before you need money could be a good way to learn what do they look for, you know, asking them. So, you know, tell me about your investment philosophy, you know, how do you decide, what do you look for, you know, and how do you collaborate. Those are all good things to do, maybe even a year or 2 years before you need their money, so that you really understand that community. It's kind of like understanding your customer, right? You want to know who your customer target is and why they would buy your product. You want to understand the investor community as well, because there are many different segments there.
Yeah, okay. I would actually, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at these ramen bowls and noodle bowls, and I would love if you could, I don't know, just kind of maybe go through some of your best-selling products. And I mean, the flavors to me sound incredible, and I haven't had lunch, so I'm actually getting
they
hungry
look delicious.
Looking at them. Yeah, and I mean, I even love the packaging, because it's like, it's very grab and go. It reminds me of like what I order a salad in or something.
Yeah, exactly. So these bowls are brand new. We're just launching them and rolling them out very soon, actually, in July. And so these bowls are a combination of the noodles and the broths that we've always had traditionally, more in kind of a cook-at-home format, and we decided to create even more convenience around it. And so I wanted to, you know, make this a quick grab-and-go lunchtime option, so that in 3 minutes you can have a very hearty meal. You know, so we have like a spicy miso ramen bowl, which is made with a organic chicken bone broth, but we make it more like a tonkotsu style, so it's really creamy with the soy milk, it has miso, and it has the funky flavor of fermented bean paste.
That umami.
Absolutely, lots of umami there with the ramen, and that alone is like 24 grams of protein.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm like, man, I wish I still like had a job I went to every day, because this is what I would want to take for lunch, and it'd be like, this is my healthy lunch that, you know, I didn't go out and buy. I brought it from home.
There you go.
Feels like I made it myself.
Yeah, I like to think that this is not your kind of like top ramen upgrade. This is like your momofuku on the go.
I love that.
How do you come up with the flavors and combinations that you serve either in these bowls or in your products across the board?
You know, like, honestly, we just play around with it. Like, you know, we came up with like a whole bunch of different flavors and shoyu and miso. Then we're like, you know, like some flavors just didn't give me the wow factor. And because this is a packaged product, it's not like we could include that, you know, soft boiled egg, and we can't include chicken or pork belly. So there are certain things that we can't put in there, or even shallots, because they have no shelf life, right? So we have to create something that still has good shelf life, tastes great, is filling, and doesn't feel that it's missing anything. So there are actually quite a lot of, I don't know, management consulting background, like different factors that we look at. Like the dandan noodle bowl, I love it. I wanted a, you know, kind of something that's more saucy, and we end up working with Beyond Meat. And so we use their crumbles, we saute it, and then we put it with a sauce so that you mix it with the ramen. And even naming as well, right? Because it's really kind of a, I didn't like it too peanutty, so we scaled back on the tahini. And so a lot of it is my flavor palette. But I wanted to have that crumbles. And so it's almost a cross between like a jjajangmyeon and a dandan noodle bowl. But, you know, have fun trying to get people to be able to pronounce jjajangmyeon.
Say it one more time slowly.
Jjajangmyeon.
Jjajangmyeon.
Yeah, there you go. But if it's spelled out right, it's like.
So I mean, I guess that's that concern is present in a lot of what you do. You're taking flavors. You know, the three on the table in front of us are dandan noodles and green curry and Valerie, what's the one over
spicy
there?
Spicy miso ramen.
So you're taking flavors that are, you know, fairly traditional to particular Asian cuisines, and putting them in a grab and go format for a presumably not primarily an Asian audience.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to translate flavors and translate traditional dishes in both of those ways, both for the audience but also for the format?
I mean, that is a good question, right? Which is, we don't claim to make things exactly the same way as it is made in Asia, you know, by virtue of getting something that's clean label, right? You could say that, hey, a lot of Asian cuisine, they love to put in MSG in there, which is fine. Or they have, you know, certain ingredients in there which might have preservatives. And so by eliminating some of those, it's already not considered exactly 100% made the same way, right? So we don't claim that. But what I try to do is to take those flavors that I love and that I grew up with, that I'm exposed to, and bring it and give it a modern sensibility. So in a way whereby I know that I would love it as an Asian, and I get really happy when I have a lot of other Asians who say they love it. So I know that, hey, that's kind of the benchmark that is great enough, but also still want to make it accessible so that, you know, non-Asians could enjoy it. And so it's always a fine balance. Like the dandan noodle bowl, like for me, I love chilies and spice. I can eat like a whole Thai chili, cut it up, and I'll just eat it with some soy sauce in my meal. But that's not the majority of the population, Asian or otherwise, right? So we did dial back the spicy Sichuan peppercorn in a dandan noodle bowl to a level where we think that it has enough heat, because we still want to make sure that it tastes pretty authentic and you get that kick, but not making it overwhelming so that it excludes, you know, a large part of the population. And that is definitely an art. I think we must have done that, you know, 20 or 30 iterations. It's almost to get that spice level right. You know, or like we did a Indian lentil soup. And so, you know, it has cumin in there, it has turmeric, it's all these different spices, and we played with it, and we need to get it just right. Like getting the main soup more or less dialed in was okay, and then we spent, again, many, many, many iterations just on the ratio of the spices to get the flavor right. That, oh, is that too much heat in the back, in the front, you know, and if you chill it and you reheat it, do you lose some of it? Because that's a different thing, right? If you cook it and you eat it straight away,
right,
it will taste very different than if you were to chill it and then to eat it. And how would it taste a week later, 2 weeks later, you know, if you add lime juice to it, which brightens up, lime juice or lemon juice brightens up the flavor of the dish, which is awesome. But then, you know, when you chill it down, you eat it like 3 days later, oh my gosh, it's so sour. Does it taste like it's gone off? Right? So we have to, it's an art to just keep tasting.
Yeah. And I love that you have actually, like, on the packaging, there are little chilies that give you an indication of how spicy it is. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm from South Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So we are no stranger to spicy food, but it is so relative, like how much spice can someone handle? So I can only imagine, because I'm kind of going through recipe development right now myself, I can only imagine like how many iterations and how many different like people you tested to kind of get to that place. But
did you have flavors that didn't work?
Oh yeah.
That things that you wanted to make, things that flavors that you were trying to get to and couldn't get.
Absolutely. like we did a, you know, the Taiwanese beef noodle. Mm. So we did an iteration of that, which I absolutely love. And then we had actually some investors try our board members and things like that. And they're like, man, no. You know? And so,
what was their criticism?
They're just not used to the combination of spices.
Okay.
You know, because there's like a lot of like different cinnamon and star anise and all that. And so what we try to do, honestly, a lot of it is just listening to customers. Like a lot of times at trade shows, we'll actually bring a lot of R&D product and we'll have them under the table and then we'll
I think, yeah, the Fancy Food Show in San Francisco last year, you pulled out the Indian lentil soup, the dal that you were working on. This is a secret thing that we're trying
Absolutely.
Out.
It's yeah. great because then I get feedback from everyone, right? And there's so many other brands out there, manufacturers, they all have great palates. You know, just get their feedback and they'll be saying, oh yeah, no, this is good, this is not good. Like, oh, this is spicy, do you have this? In fact, like the chili spice thing on the bowl that came from feedback at one of those trade shows. And we'll ask them like, oh, do you see this as one chili or two chilies? Again, you know, for me, it might be no chili.
Right.
So definitely a lot of it is around talking and asking and looking for feedback.
In the last few minutes of the conversation, we're going to do our fun, lighthearted. We always call it rapid fire, but it's never that rapid. So maybe we should drop that label. But yeah,
I like the label.
The rapid fire
yeah,
label. All right, so
it's like a goal.
Okay, the goal is rapid fire, but take as long as you want to answer the question. So we're just going to throw some. We didn't really. I have to tell the listener that we didn't really prepare Nona very well for this segment. So we're putting her on the spot, but she's a competitive fencer. She can handle pressure, right?
This is a competition.
Yes. Who's she competing against?
The
all
clock.
Of the other all the other guests who've answered these questions.
How many questions you get through?
Right. Oh yeah, good. So if you could master any skill overnight, what would that be?
Oh. I would love to master the skill of learning anything I can overnight.
Oh. so meta. It's like you're given a genie a lamp
right.
and you ask for more wishes. What is it about mastering skills that...
Because then I don't have to choose which skill to master.
Oh, okay. All right. There we go. So, and this is why you have a line of...
18 skills. I have a lot of choices.
18 skills from 18 different cuisines because you can't choose
exactly.
Which one to focus on. I love it.
All right. I'm giving you another question like that, but it's more of a closed universe.
Okay.
Favorite country you have lived in or visited? And I know that favorite is a strange word.
Japan. Yeah. I just love the cuisine there. It is just absolutely amazing. The people are so nice. And skiing is awesome there if you're into skiing or snowboarding.
Wow.
Are you a skier or a snowboarder?
I started off snowboarding years ago and then...
Like most Singaporeans.
I know. And then got all bruised. No, actually I did that in London. So, and then, you know... Daughter was born and it's like, oh, I haven't done anything. And she started to learn how to ski. So now I decided to pick up skiing.
Do you feel like one or does that say something about your personality if you're a snowboarder versus a skier?
Nah.
Okay.
Not at all. But anyway, the best thing about Japan skiing there is the onsen. Well, first of all, you get a big bowl of ramen at lunch and then you can go to the hot springs and you have all those amazing cuisine. So I think it's my favorite country.
So the best part about skiing in Japan is what you eat for lunch and yes. what you do after you're finished.
Exactly.
that's my kind of trap.
I mean, compare that to hot dogs.
Oh,
you
yeah,
know,
for sure.
Pizza, you know?
Like Swiss Miss watery hot chocolate.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm
with you.
I wish that like the places convenient to New York City, the ski lodges would serve like something just slightly more like, I don't know, enticing. Mm. But what I'm just curious, just... What area in Japan were you or what mountain range was it?
Niseko, but it's really...
Oh,
go to Hokkaido, but Niseko is getting a little bit too crowded.
Okay.
And so there are some other resorts around Niseko that are less crowded that you should definitely check those out. Avoid Christmas New Year and avoid like the Lunar New Year period. It is overrun there.
That was the Winter Olympics they had there, right? I think so.
In Japan?
Yeah.
I think so.
All right. Next
anyway,
question.
if anybody needs Japan skiing recommendations, call Nona.
Exactly.
Next question. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, the ability to vaporize and appear anywhere in the
you
world.
You know, that's what, that's so consistent. That's everybody what almost everybody that? Says. Teleportation, flying, transportation is everybody's biggest problem.
Oh, maybe the other one, though. Well, how about that?
I mean, I'm not trying to talk
I,
you out
I
of
liked it because
it.
You said vaporize.
Yeah, you definitely said it more
very,
poetically.
It was very steamy, bone brothy. Yeah,
out of you your go. Japanese yeah. hot springs into...
Exactly.
Where would you... Why is transportation appealing?
Well, because my family is still in Singapore. Right, ability to fly, I'm not quite sure I'll have the stamina to fly that far, right? But with vaporizing...
I mean, it's a superpower. You could have the stamina if you wanted.
That's true, but it still takes too long. Yeah. Whereas that one is instantaneous. It's much faster.
And your second, you're starting to say you had a second idea for a superpower.
Yes. What is that X-Men guy? Xavier. Mm.
Oh, who can control
change
mind, the world.
Control minds? Mm. Control minds?
So what would you make people do?
Buy my bone broth?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's a great answer.
So practical.
World peace?
Yeah. Yeah, world
change
peace
change the minds
and bone
of certain
broth.
Politicians?
Yeah.
So much you could do with it.
Yeah. Favorite meal growing up in Singapore?
Is it meal of the day or dish?
Oh, meal like a dish.
Oh, my gosh. Too many. Anything from the... street food, everything from fishball noodles to hor fun to fried kway teow to roti prata to nasi lemak, all these dishes that you probably are not quite familiar with.
I'm not, but they're still making me hungry.
We'll go get on a plane. We could be in Singapore by tomorrow.
Right. I have no idea what you said, but I want them all.
What's the best meal you've ever had that cost, I don't know, less than $5?
In the US or in Singapore?
Anywhere in the world.
Oh. Everything.
Everything in Singapore.
Everything that I just named right. would be like, even with the, you know, by today's standard, maybe it would cost you about $3. I mean, when I was growing up, it's probably more like a dollar. Now it's probably about $3 to $4. Yeah, all those dishes.
How do you, in raising your daughter, how do you keep her sort of in touch with her Singaporean heritage?
Well, first of all, we go back regularly. That's one good way of doing that. And she eats a lot of noodles. She has noodles every week. So, you know, so I love that, you know, she could be having noodles for breakfast, which is kind of unusual for Americans, or she could be having, you know, your scrambled eggs and bacon. And so she's definitely very well-rounded. You know, she could be eating raw oysters, which she loves.
Yeah.
How
like
old is she?
6. She started eating oysters at like 3 or 4.
Wow.
Like,
that's so cool.
Very expensive, though.
Nona, it's been such a pleasure having you join us today. Tell our listeners where they can find your products and read more about you and your work.
Yeah. So our products are available at Whole Foods nationwide and down to Walmart as well. You know, hopefully most natural co-op independents and online. So we ship nationwide.
And your website?
NonaLim.com.
NonaLim.com.
Exactly.
And Instagram, social media?
NonaLimFoods.com.
And if people have questions, are looking for some advice, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Nona@nonalim.com.
Great.
I love the consistency.
Yeah. Is it weird? Is it confusing having your company and you have the same name?
Absolutely. You know, I would call someone and say, hi, I'm looking for so-and-so. What's your name? Oh, Nona. What company are you from? Nona Lim. Like, and the receptionist or whoever on the other side were like, huh? Takes a while.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for joining us. As always, you can reach us via yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can reach us on social at yfood, at yfoodpodcast. I should know that. Anyway, you can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, ethan@burlapandbarrel.com.
And I'm Valerie. You can find me on Instagram at foodie in New York or my website, foodieinnewyork.com.
Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.